Tango Tango Papa 1891, January 3rd, 2015.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from New Caney, Texas. So I unloaded in Memphis, Tennessee, and then I ended up reloading at West Memphis, and that was I delivered on the 2nd, January 2nd in Memphis. And then the next load picked up this morning, or it was actually this morning, in West Memphis. So I spent the night there in the Memphis area. And that was a drop and hook there at West Memphis at a cold storage. And so then the load delivers in the afternoon on the 4th, which now is tomorrow, at New Caney, Texas, or kind of, I'm close to it. I think I'm about, according to the GPS, I've got about, it says 14 miles or so to go. So, and I can be there an hour. They don't want me there until an hour before the appointment time. I think the appointment time is maybe like, it's an odd time. It's like 2:55 or something like that. I'll have to look at it again tomorrow afternoon, so that means I'll have to be there at 1:55, if, you know, for example. So, anyway, I'm here, and so I drove and got about as close as I could, because there's no overnight parking at the place where I'll be unloading at. And this is probably about the closest truck stops, or at least one of the closest. So anyway, never really did run into any kind of ice, at least where I was at. Temperature was in, when I was on my way to Memphis, at one time I saw 33 degrees and it was kind of drizzling. But most of the time it was 36, 37 degrees, and then all day today the temperature's kind of been in the I've seen temperatures sort of in the 40s. Actually, when I left West Memphis this morning, it was I think I even saw maybe 50 or 51 degrees. But then this evening, I don't know what the temperature is now. It's chilly, of course. It's more humid down here in this part of southeastern Texas. It's fairly chilly here. I'd say the temperature is in the 40s, probably 45, or maybe by now maybe a 44 or something like that. I don't know what the, without looking, I guess I can look right now on the phone, but without looking, I'm guessing that it probably is going to be in the 40s. Now, it says 44 right now, but I'll force it to update and see what it says. It's 44, and I guess tomorrow it's supposed to get up to 55 here with a low of 38. So, and it's clear here, so it's not, there's no precipitation here that's going on. So anyway, and of course once the load's unloaded, see what they come up with. So, but, so anyway, just, kind of back at work, and, today was a very uneventful day. One thing I've noticed, now typically over the Christmas holiday, Christmas is usually there's a lot of truck stops that will go ahead and close. Now, of course, I was at home Christmas. So typically over the Christmas holiday, you'll have the least number of trucks on the road. And then there's usually sort of a dip in the amount of trucks on the road between Christmas and New Year's. But I don't recall, because there's been plenty of times when I come right back to work after Christmas, and I don't recall the truck stops quite being as empty as they have been the past several days, and I'm not seeing that many trucks on the road either. So I don't know. Now that's probably subject to change Sunday evening. Tonight, this is Saturday, so tomorrow being Sunday, I would think everything should ramp back up and kind of get back to normal. And so you probably have, starting tomorrow, there'll probably be a lot more trucks kind of out and about. But it's the past several days since I came back to work on the 30th. And it's even during the week, it's been pretty easy to find a place to park at night. Truck stops that are normally very busy have had parking spots after dark, you know, towards late in the evening, which that's kind of interesting. So I don't know if that's really signifies anything or not from an economy standpoint. Probably not. It's hard to say. I would say that it may be that there's just more drivers that, for whatever reason, that took off in between, you know, the entire holiday from between Christmas and New Year's. But as I say, normally they would be back by now. But this was a weekend, so it's possible since people are possibly kind of extending the thing out until Sunday, and then everyone will kind of go back to work on Monday. And I would imagine that a lot of people have done that. I don't know, but so in any case, I found it pretty easy to find parking spots. As I say, the past several nights, and just kind of looking in the truck stops, I'm noticing the ones that are normally very busy, where it's maybe after a certain period of time, a certain time at night during the week, you would probably never find a parking spot. There's multiple parking spots. So that's kind of interesting. So while I was home, and my parents were there, and I was having a discussion with my parents, and you know, they were kind of talking about behavior of relatives, and it's kind of popular, and I don't remember exactly the context of the conversation, but it's kind of popular for people to knock people for whipping out their smartphones. And people have been doing that now for a few years since smartphones have become very popular. People sort of, any kind of a dinner or any kind of a gathering or practically anywhere, people will sort of whip out their mobile devices, their smartphones in particular. And it's popular for some people to kind of complain about that. And they'll kind of whine and moan and groan, and they'll say, well, the people, they're no longer engaging in conversation. And that got me, it popped into my head, well, maybe if you're at a family dinner, let's say, for example, do you really want, and I'm just kind of asking the question generically, do you really want to engage with your relatives as much as you possibly could? And I'd say sometimes the answer might be yes, but it's just as likely that it could be no, sort of depending on potential personality clashes that you have between different family members. So it got me to thinking, it's really, we shouldn't be complaining at all about people kind of lose, you know, their attention being taken by the smartphone in social, especially in family social situations and perhaps other ones. That's actually a good thing that people are kind of diverting their attention to their smartphones. And I think that's especially true with people that you would potentially have trouble with in the past. Maybe they would say something that they shouldn't have said, or they would kind of engage in their typical behavior that they're not even aware of, because people aren't, they're not aware of their own behavior. They're not aware of how they may rub other people the wrong way. And even if they are, they can't really stop themselves. They just do it, you know. People have this idea that people, if they would just look at the world logically, they could change their behavior, and of course they can't. Most of the time they can't change their behavior because they're not even aware of their own behavior. Say you have someone that's sort of a kind of a jerk and has a knack for maybe pissing people off or saying the wrong thing. Well, they're not even aware that chances are that they're doing that. So next time you're in a social situation and you have, let's say, family members or whoever, and they're all kind of, you know, part of them will whip out their smartphones and are kind of going through their email or whatever it is, that's actually a good thing. You want them to do that, because in those situations, chances are it's going to reduce the potential for conflict. So that's actually a good thing. You want your relatives, brother-in-laws, sister-in-laws, whoever, children, you want them whipping out their smartphones and kind of paying attention to them, as opposed to trying to engage in conversation. Because, as I say, oftentimes you really don't want to. Because you can kind of laugh about this, but there is an element of truth to it. Because before smartphones, oftentimes, sometimes different types of family dinners, in particular, you'd end up with one or more people, or at least the people I was around would be around afterwards, would be complaining about, well, this person said that, or that person acted this way, or whatever it is, and or more likely they said something and it kind of rubbed whoever the wrong way. Well, if what I observe is that if they're kind of, those same people now are sort of engaged with their smartphones part of the time, they're probably less likely to say something or rub another person the wrong way. They're probably more likely to just, they're just kind of sitting there playing with their device part of the time. And that's, as I say, that's actually a good thing. You want them engaged with their smartphone. You want them kind of paying it, at least in part, paying attention to that. And it's more likely that they're going to be able to get along with the group. And maybe especially specific individuals within the group, it's more likely that they're going to be able to, that you're not going to end up with as much potential for strife. So next time you hear someone complain about, well, all they did was just they had their smartphones and they wouldn't talk to each other or whatever, you tell them, hey, that's actually a good thing. It's really a good thing that they do that. I was listening to something the other day, or there was an article, I think I saw a headline, and there was some, and I've seen this same story happen a few times, where there was some restaurant somewhere, and they were offering like a 10% discount if people would not have their smartphones. 10% or whatever, maybe it was 5%. Discount towards the overall bill if the people would not get out their smartphones. Well, nonsense. Even as a restaurateur, you want them to do that. Now, on the other hand, they complain that, well, the people, it takes them longer to eat, or it takes them longer to place their order and to eat because they have their smartphones and they're not paying attention to the menu, and maybe they don't order as quickly, or it takes them longer to eat their food. Well, if it takes you longer to eat your food, that's actually a good thing, because if the longer you take to eat your food, the more likely it is that you're going to end up feeling full, because it can take about 20 minutes for that really full feeling to kind of kick in. And if you eat too fast, you still don't feel full, but yet your stomach is full, and as I say, it takes about 20 minutes. So if you can do something like have a smartphone, or like this evening, I went in this, I'm at a Flying J here at the Flying J here at New Caney, Texas, and they have a Denny's in there, so I went in there a while ago and ate, and so while I was sitting there eating, I had my phone, of course. And I was reading an article. It was actually a very long, kind of a long interview of the movie director that directed the movie Interstellar. Which, by the way, I did go see that while I went met a friend and at the theater and saw that. I don't think that was one of the things I did while I was off. I don't think I mentioned that the other day when I did the podcast the other day, but I did see Interstellar, and it's an okay movie. Great special effects, and I don't know that the plot was, I would say the plot was a little bit weak, but that's true of a lot of movies. A lot of movies have weak plots, so this one was sort of kind of weak, and it had some really unbelievable stuff in it later in the movie. The whole thing really kind of went off the deep end, but it was an okay movie. It's entertaining. So anyway, I went and saw that. So I sat there and I read the article, and as I say, it was a very long interview. It was, I think it was in maybe Hollywood Variety or something or other. I'd have to look at the website again. But anyway, it was kind of an interesting article, and of course, the guy was kind of helping to promote the movie a little bit. And it was kind of interesting, but it was interesting enough to hold my attention, and I read the entire thing. And so I was reading that as I was kind of eating, and then it was long enough, I've kind of finished the food off slowly, and then I still had a bunch to read, and so I continued to read it. As I was drinking my hot tea, I continued to read it, and then finally the tea was all gone, and I was continuing to read. So I may have read some other articles too while I was eating before I hit that article. That article was kind of towards the end of, probably the end of the food. So, but it's better if you slow down while you're eating. So, what better way of slowing down the eating process than you got something to read, something good to read. So smartphones and mobile devices in general, but smartphones are really good things, and it's good to engage with them. This idea that people are complaining that they're not getting their attention, or they're losing their attention, that's ridiculous. I don't want to engage with everybody all the time. Them having their phones is a great thing. Maybe it's also that applies to me too. Keep me busy too. Keep my foot out of my mouth. So anyway, I was kind of thinking about, there's this Bible verse, and it says, and I can't tell you exactly where it's at. It's in there in the New Testament somewhere, I think, or it may be in the Old Testament for all I know. But it basically says to pursue you know, kind of pursue to the end. You know, and you'll find the beginning. You know, now that sounds kind of poetic, and it sounds like a riddle. And then it says, you know, for all those who have understanding or ears to hear, let them hear, or that type of thing. You know, pursue, you know, kind of pursue to the end to find the beginning. And there you'll find the beginning, or something to that effect. Now, what does that mean? And it kind of struck me. It kind of means what it says. It sound, you can take that the wrong way, and it sounds like a riddle, but it's really not. What does it mean to, you'll find the beginning? And it's actually pretty simple. If you really pursue the truth, as you go along, it's not, the truth isn't some instant thing that happens, as I've said many times. The truth, you kind of get, it's bit by bit by bit. And it's kind of an analog process. And it's not something you're just going to run into all at once and you're suddenly saved and, you know, all of that nonsense. It's much more of an analog process, and it might take your entire lifetime. And it's actually better if it does. But what does that mean? You find the beginning. Well, what is it that we lament? You know, the idea you're born in sin and you kind of don't have a chance, and you immediately begin resenting your parents and resenting this and resenting that, and it's kind of like you don't really have a chance to start off on the right foot. People, you know, you hear people say, well, it, you know, their life isn't fair, and they want to, somehow they want to try to make it fair. They resent the fact that it's not fair. And so what is the beginning? How would you get back? Think of it in terms of how would you get, you know, getting back to your innocence. Or, you know, in our case, because we're born in sin, finding your innocence for the first time. And that's really what it means. It means you find your way to the innocence that Adam lost, is really what it means. It's really, so it does kind of say what it means. And it means what it says, but it also can kind of end up sounding like a riddle. But it's really not a riddle. If you want to kind of find the innocence that Adam lost, if you go back to the Adam and Eve story, if you want to find that perfect relationship with your Creator, you pursue to the end. You pursue the truth to the very end. And that's all that means. And you have to be willing to let go of resentment. And oftentimes people will say, I've had people tell me, well, resentment, you just turn it, you have to turn it into something positive, and you can't live without it, and it's normal because everybody has it. And but you have to be willing to let go of it. And then, you know, the other thing is, well, if you, you know, why would you want to let go of it? Because you're going to get some kind of reward or something, you know. And you have to be, ultimately, you have to be willing to let go of it because you see that it's wrong. You have to be willing, you have to be able. And you have to be able to see that it's something that you don't want. And you have to, and therefore, if you really see that you don't want it, you really see that it's detrimental, it's like battery acid, sort of like swimming in battery acid, you don't want to do that. One time when I was a kid, my dad had a, you know, my dad always had pickups, and he had the tailgate down. There was a, I don't know, I don't remember, there was a battery, I don't know if it was sitting, I think it was sitting on the tailgate, but But in any case, I sat down on the tailgate. And I sat there for a while, and, you know, all of a sudden my bottom started to get irritated, and come to find out, the battery was leaking. I was sitting in some battery acid. You know, of course, what do? I want up and get those pants off. So resentment is kind of like battery. You don't want it. But you have to be willing to let go of it because you don't, you know, you see that it's detrimental. You really have to see that it's detrimental. But you have to be willing to let go without any kind of promise of a reward. Because if you're doing it for the reward, you think there's some reward for letting go. Now, of course, there is. You get rid of the, you know, in the case of the battery acid, when I jumped up and realized what was going on, and then go in and change the pants, and maybe, I don't remember if I'm sure I probably took a bath or a shower or something afterwards. You get rid of the irritation. And that's really what you get rid of. You lose the, you know, you get rid of the resentment. You get rid of the external control that the world has on you. But at the same time, there's no promise, really. What promise is there? What promise do you have that you're going to get a God, you know, that God is going to be there, and you're going to end up with kind of your God-given identity? A measure of it back. What promise is there? There isn't. But you have to be willing to give up the resentment without any kind of idea that you're going to get a reward, because if you do it with the idea you're going to end up with a reward, you're just playing kind of a game. It's kind of like, let's make a deal kind of a prayer, you know, well, God, if you'll do this and I'll do that, which is absurd. As I've said many times before, you know, what kind of prayer is it when you ask God for a new car, or you ask him for a new house? Are you asking for a better love life? Or maybe a new iPod? What kind of prayer is that? It's an egotistical, absurd sort of prayer. And it's not even really a prayer. I don't know what you'd call it. Other than ridiculous. So, anyway, how long have I been going? I think this is probably going to end up being a little bit shorter podcast. What time is it? It's 11:30, and probably need to start thinking about getting to bed as opposed to staying. You know, I've been trying, lately I haven't been staying up that late. Well, not as late as I could. There's been times when I've been off, especially if I've been off work, I would stay up really, really late and then sleep half the day away. And so this time I really didn't do that as much. There were a couple of times where I stayed up pretty late, but I had to get up early anyway, or I got up relatively early. So unless I have to, it's better to try to keep day, you know, night, and day, and typically I'll go to bed around maybe midnight or a little bit after, and that's kind of normal for me, depending. But news-wise, still reading the headlines. It never gets better. It just gets worse. Uh, And of course, people end up, as it gets worse, people end up kind of more and more unhappy. And it's tempting to think, well, all we have to do is just kind of, you know, you have your idea of what led to the unhappiness, and you think you can just somehow reverse that, and you'll have your happiness back. And of course, what you don't realize is what really led to your unhappiness in the first place isn't what happened, but your reaction to it. Because whatever happened might be wrong, or it might be right. Either way, but if you have a wrong reaction to whatever it is, especially if it's bad, that's especially true. If you have a wrong reaction to injustice, let's say, for example, some sort of an injustice, it could be, you know, a friend or a relative or your employer, or just society in general is perpetrating some sort of an injustice on you, and you have a bad reaction to it, meaning you resent it, then that's even worse. And quite frankly, you deserve to be miserable. If you resent anything, I can make this kind of a blanket statement. If you resent anything, you deserve the misery that it brings on. I'm sorry, but you deserve it. But people are so unwilling to even see resentment as a problem. They think, as I said before, that some people think, well, they can just sort of, if they admit that it's a problem, then they think, well, I can make it something positive. You know, kind of like the Mothers Against Drunk Driving. You know, that you resent the alcoholic that ran over your family. You resent them, and so you're going to turn it into, you know, something positive where you put alcoholics down. And somehow that's positive. Sort of the inverse of idolizing. Or conversely, people idolize things thinking that's going to make things positive. You know, if you can idolize this type of behavior, or idolize that type of behavior, or idolize this politician, or idolize you know, basically people and places and things, idolize that somehow that even if it's right, or you think that it's right, or you know, somehow it's going to have a positive effect, and of course it doesn't. It can't. And therefore, if idolizing is bad, so is demonizing. You know, you demonize anything, demonize a kind of behavior, you know, you may, you know, it's going to have a negative effect. Both things, because you're reacting in the wrong way, whether you're idolizing something or demonizing something, if you do that, kind of, you know, with the wrong side of your ego, it ends up having a negative effect overall. So these people, you know, the Ferguson, Missouri, or the people that are protesting in New York, I guess they are, I'm not seeing the articles or the headlines now, but they can't really explain to you what's gone wrong, but they know that something's wrong. They know that they're miserable. Their souls are in a state of atrophy, but of course then they're encouraged, well, you know, resent the white people, for example, the black people in the inner city. Resent the white people. They're hurting you somehow. There, it's them. Point the finger at them. They're hurting you. Tear the system down. But they know something's missing. And it's really the something that's missing among, you know, at the root is that their souls are in a state of atrophy. Because, you know, they've been encouraged to resent, and then they've been, by their own culture. And then they've been sort of coddled so that they can keep the nurturing the resentment. Keep it around. And, of course, it keeps them in a state of slavery. All who sin are slaves. You know, people idolize everything. I see idolization everywhere. And people think that, even to the point where people think, well, if we can just idolize religion. And that's basically why religion has failed, is because it wasn't real. It wasn't real. It was just idolatry. And so you see what it, by its fruits you'll know it. You know, and you see what happens. Country falls apart anyway. Because it wasn't real, it was fake. It was false, it was phony. It's idolization. You know, you get involved with your mega church or whatever, you might as well just be going to the bar. Or you might as well just, move to Colorado, as I said before, move to Colorado and become a marijuana junkie. Might as well, for all the good it's going to do you. Chances are, if you're taking your kids to that, chances are they'll see through it. And they'll see it's just hypocrisy and it's empty and what the hell are they doing there? And they'll end up rejecting it in the end anyway. You just turn, and they may throw the whole baby out with the bathwater. You know, reject religion in its entirety. You know, and the left, the far left, kind of the atheist left evolves out of the hypocritical right. The supposedly religious. And people worship, they have their fan worship. They worship, the movie stars, or they worship, they got something that they're fans of. Maybe it's a comic book thing, and they're big fans, and people say, oh, I'm a fan. Well, they're fanatic. Of what? What do you think fan is short for? It's fanatic. It's a root word. That's idolatry. It's worship. And typically, if you're a fan of whatever, and if it's a person, usually they're the biggest idolaters of all. Somehow they're able to. People will pick people will idolize someone that somehow they fascinate them. I think often that fascination revolves around the fact that the people that they're idolizing are the biggest idolaters of all. And somehow they seem to be able to do it without conscience. And of course, typically, you look at the Hollywood star type thing, and of course one of the best examples, somebody like Elvis Presley or Michael Jackson, people worship, and then they seem to, you know, kind of, you know, in the case of Michael Jackson just got really, really bizarre, but people worshipped him, and he was really good at dancing, and somehow he was really good at kind of taking conscience away, because, you know, if you're going to be a good, false idol, you have to be able to kind of have some sort of a knack for kind of separating people from their conscience. But in order to keep his own conscience at bay, what did he have to do? He had to do drugs. He had to he had to keep his own conscience away. He had to keep reality away, so that he could kind of keep everyone else's, all of the fans, all of the little people fans, keep their conscience away. But he had to keep, you know, of course, when someone's in that position, they're in a very dangerous position, because it drives them to do really terrible things in order to kill or, you know, keep their own conscience sort of deadened. And typically it revolves around drugs. They become addicted to drugs. And of course, in the case of Michael Jackson, he was able to just sort of buy his own doctor, and he could have anything he wanted, and he went nuts with the plastic surgery. But the drugs are what ended up killing him. In the case of Elvis Presley, he pretty much, I think, he, you know, it was a combination of, you know, him kind of eating himself to death, plus lots of prescription drugs. He had all these people, all particularly women, worshiping him. Like he was some sort of, and they're still doing it. Even the dead image. There were the image of Elvis Presley now, the long since dead, you know, man, but they've got this image that they worship. Is more his estate is more successful than ever, and these people are knowingly worshiping this dead image. This image of this dead man. It's really bizarre when you think about it. So it's really very bizarre. And it often, you know, people think, oh, they want to be a movie star or whatever, and be famous and rich and have all the worship. And that's actually a very deadly thing. There's very few of them that actually have a high level of success that are actually able to survive unscathed, because typically it ends up destroying them. Look how many, they drop dead like flies. There's always stories, if you look, there's always stories of so-called Hollywood stars that are these Hollywood celebrities, and they're constantly dying of drug overdoses and God knows what else. Mostly drugs. But being worshipped that way is very dangerous. Bad enough for the person doing the worshiping, and it's deadly if you get thousands or let's say millions of quote unquote fans sort of worshiping you, then you begin to believe that you're really something special. You're in deep trouble, because that sets up a tremendous conflict. And they have to get rid of the conflict with drugs. They have to have more and more drugs in order to try to eliminate the conflict. sooner or later they die of drug overdose, or their or some part of their body just gives up because they've abused it so much in an effort to get rid of the conflict. So I have a piece of audio, voicemail from Ian, kind of asking a question. And so let me go ahead and play that. So here is Ian.
I have a question for you, Tom. On a video I saw today, the guy talked about parking his truck in the door, and the company made him pull out from underneath his trailer, and they came out and they put a lock on his air system so that there's absolutely no way that he could move away from the dock. And he explained that maybe this was to do with the fact that some drivers had pulled away while there were people unloading their trucks, or had left the forklift in the truck and they didn't want to get their forklift stolen. Have you ever had experience with having your brakes locked on your trailer and then you had to pull out and then obviously you could reconnect?
Okay, well, thank you, Ian, for the question. I've told a story before. Yes, I have. All the time I'm going to warehouses where, Walmart warehouses in particular, they will make you disconnect the truck from the trailer. Sometimes they'll have you pull forward typically, and then if you hook to the trailer and, you know, before you get your paperwork, you're subject to being banned from ever coming back. Even at Walmart, I have had them also come out and put a lock on the trailer. It's kind of up to the individual warehouses, but at the very least, they're going to make you drop the trailer and pull forward. Sometimes they'll have you pull clear to a completely, like to a bobtail area. But there's plenty of places, a lot of cold storages, grocery warehouses, that will come out. Maybe they don't make you disconnect from the trailer, but they'll come out and put what's called a glad hand lock on the active trailer brake. You have two air lines that go from the tractor to the trailer, and one of them, whenever the trailer brakes have to actually be released, they're released with an active pressure from the truck, to one side of the brake system when it's in the released state, so the trailer can be freely moved. It has to have an active air connection, and so they remove that one, and that's the red one. There's a red one and a blue one, so they'll when you're parked, they'll remove the red line, and then they attach their glad hand lock to the trailer. To the glad hand on the trailer. The glad hand is basically, it's a connector. The two things kind of fit together and kind of, sort of lock together in a, sort of an embrace, if you will. And the glad hands are made of metal, and they've got a rubber gasket on each side that kind of forms the seal. So, when they're sort of pressured together, and when they're kind of put together. So that happened, but I've told the story before, but years ago, we'd be back probably early 80s. I was at a Sam's Club, and this was back when Sam's Club was pretty new. They had limited number of locations. Of course, Sam's Club is owned by Walmart. They had a number of locations, and they were kind of in the Midwest. You had, some in Arkansas, and then a lot. There were several locations in Texas, and I think at that time they were mostly in Texas, and you had maybe one or two in Oklahoma, and maybe one in Kansas, and wherever. And so that's kind of where they started out as. And I think it, Sam's Club kind of started out as an experiment, and then it kind of grew over the years. But in any case, I was delivering quite a bit to Sam's Club, and there would always be these outside carriers delivering to Sam's Club. They'd typically have about five docks, and they'd start very, let's say 5:30 in the morning or whatever, and you'd start, and drivers would kind of have to wait until the dock became open, and then maybe back in, and so you'd always have a bunch of trucks there sort of waiting. Since then, they've kind of changed their system, and you know, I think in a lot of cases, the stuff is just coming directly from the Walmart distribution centers as opposed to outside carriers delivering to them. But in any case, their policy, even back in the early 80s, the Sam's Club policy was that as soon as the load was unloaded, they were supposed to raise the dock plate, you know, kind of release, or, you know, basically, you know, pull the dock plate back or release it, and so that, you know, so that it would go down and would no longer be extended into the truck, and close the dock door and lock it. And that was the policy. And so, the Sam's Club employees were supposed to follow that policy. Well, I was at one, and I don't even remember what city it was in anymore. I just don't remember at this point. But in any case, it was probably, I'm assuming it was probably somewhere in Texas. But it was in the day. It was kind of more, you know, mid-morning, as I recall. Might have been in Oklahoma. I just can't remember. But it was mid-morning, and there was this driver, and he had, you know, they made the driver get inside, or, you know, come into the dock and help unload. And so he had, you know, they'd completed it, and he after they completed it, of course, the Sam's Club employee didn't put the dock door down. And in fact, he didn't even remove the dock plate. All he did was, they had like one of these long pallet jacks. You have different, you know, sort of like a motorized pallet jacks. They run on batteries. You have these motorized pallet jacks. Some of them are, you know, kind of, you know, set up so that they can lift one pallet at a time. This one was the long version, so that it would actually, you could pick up and move two pallets sort of lined up. You could move two pallets at once. So it was a long pallet, motorized pallet jack, and it was sort of half in and half out of this guy's trailer. So in the meantime, the load got unloaded, and they signed his bills and gave them to him, and he said, and this was back well before there was anybody had any idea what a cell phone was, because it was early 80s. So every place would have a payphone of some sort. You know, so the driver, well, you know, where's the payphone? I need to call. And so he went in, and he spent quite a while, as I recall, on the payphone, number of minutes, you know, probably getting his next load or whatever. And then, you know, telling him that he was empty. And then he even came back, because he was really visiting with them, and he even came back and told them bye, you know, that he's leaving, bye, see you later. You know, friendly, and then he went on, and he went out to his truck, and he started the truck up, and he, you know, after a couple of minutes, he pulled forward. Well, you know what happened? That pallet jack, that long pallet jack, all of a sudden, then they became aware, because, you know, you started to hear some noise being made, and inevitably what ended up happening, that pallet jack ended up on the ground in front of the dock. And what, you know, their policies, Sam's Club policies, that didn't get followed, ended up with the pallet jack on the ground, on the concrete in front of the dock. And that, it had someone been standing on it, or in the wrong place at the wrong time, they could have ended up either severely injured or maybe even dead. So mistakes happen. And so that's why the bigger the place, let's say you have a large corporation like Walmart, for example, and they have these, they're very strict about these policies. When you go into the distribution centers, they're very strict about making sure that you've dollied down and disconnected and chocked the wheels, and they're extremely strict about it, and I understand why. Because if people don't follow the policies, sooner or later, they're going to have accidents, and I'm sure accidents are happening anyway. So, you know, one of their yard drivers could end up hooking onto the wrong trailer, or an outside driver could end up hooking onto, it could easily end up hooking onto the wrong trailer, one that wasn't unloaded yet, perhaps, and calamity could ensue. You know, and it's been my experience that everybody, over time, everybody makes mistakes. I think I've made about every possible mistake that I could driving a truck. You know, as far as, you know, anything that can happen eventually will. You know, over the years, coming and going, and, you know, I'd go home for time off and then come back to work. Over the years, I think I have probably ended up forgetting, you know, whenever I'd leave and go back to work, I probably ended up forgetting just about every possible thing that I could. So over time, everything that can happen probably will happen, and that's just with one individual. So, you know, and if you're a big company, you start multiplying that by thousands, and you end up with serious problems. You know, a large trucking company, for example, can end up with multiple accidents per week or per month, and certainly multiple accidents per year, and it can, you know, it doesn't take many, and it's overwhelming. You know, and these things, these, you know, kind of industrial-type accidents with docks and forklifts are, you start multiplying that by thousands and thousands and thousands of docks, and you've got serious trouble. So it's, you know, I understand why, you know, there's a lot of people that, why do they make me unhook the trailer and I have to go through all? Well, the reason that they do is because they're trying to minimize as much as they possibly can. They're trying to minimize the potential for an accident. And the accidents still happen. Now, I guarantee you, they still end up with incidents or maybe even accidents or even situations where people get injured or killed. And so, you know, but that's, but this is kind of a common thing to especially at a large company, to make you disconnect from the trailer, and maybe they, or they can put a glad hand lock on it just to be sure that somebody's not, you know, that an accident or some mistake doesn't happen. The glad hand lock is actually probably, overall, that's actually more effective, I think, than disconnecting the truck from the trailer. I think that the you know, because the glad hand, you're not going to be moving the trailer as long as the glad hand, as long as you can't connect the that active air line that has to be under pressure, as long as you can't connect it, the trailer's not going to go anywhere anyway. You know, and you can't release the brakes, so on the trailer. So, but anyway, I understand why they do that, and it's a pretty common practice, especially at larger companies. It's not something that's, the only thing that's really mandated by law, typically, is the wheel has to be chalked. And, you know, sometimes you, most of the time I see people, if there's a wheel chalk, people will use it. Now, they also have a dock, you know, like a thing that comes up and grabs the, that bar that lower bar on the back of the trailer. What's that called? It's right on the tip of my tongue. There's a name for that. But it's that, if you're looking at the back end of a trailer and you see that, the kind of the bumper kind of thing along, you know, below the doors, there's a name for that and it's escaping me right now, but it's ICC bar is what that's called. ICC, Interstate Commerce Commission, but it's called an ICC bar for short. And at least in the United States, I don't know what, you know, I don't know if the Canadians call it that. Because they're not ICC. They've got their own equivalent for the interstate. I guess that would be, you know, it's interstate. No, that would be international. So, no, the Canadians have to have their own version of the Interstate Commerce Commission, you know, or the equivalent agency. But it's called an ICC bar, at least in the U.S., and it's that bar across the bottom. And so you have this, you back into these docks, and the thing, you know, they've got this thing that it's motorized, and it raises up, and it locks, you know, kind of so that if you try to pull the trailer forward, it's going to catch that ICC bar and prevent the truck from being moved. That's really more effective than a wheel chock. So if they have one of those, then they don't have to necessarily put out wheel chocks. But, you know, but those are the only thing, you know, some sort of a restraint system is required by law. But as far as disconnecting or having that glad hand lock for the trailer, those are not mandated by law, to my knowledge. But companies kind of come up with those as a way to prevent mishaps. And I'm sure, you know, and people, you know, they don't arrive at these policies in a vacuum. You know, I'm sure that most of them, you know, since they're dealing with docks every day, day in and day out, trucks backing into a dock and a forklift driving into the trailer, accidents are happening, and they have to try to do something to stop those accidents or to mitigate them, prevent them from happening in the first place. Otherwise, they're not going to be in business very long. So anyway, that I hope that answers the question there, Ian. So thanks again for the question. Anyway, as I said, I need to be cutting this off. Hope everyone is having a great weekend so far. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.